and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, September 22nd. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. Today's article, Pulaski's teammates cheering him on. Over the last 14 NHL seasons, hockey fans have learned a lot about former Waterloo Blackhawk Joel Pulaski. During that time, he has played in over 1,200 NHL regular season games, a Stanley Cup playoff games, Winter Olympic games. Pulaski has been a team captain. He has skated in all-star events. Monday, he was on the ice for Game 2 in the 2020 Stanley Cup Final. It's the second time he has helped a team into the shadow of the most coveted trophy in sports. Pulaski scored for Dallas in a 3-2 loss in the Tampa Bay Lightning that tied the series one game apiece. The goal moved him into a tie with Mike Modano, 58, for the second most goals among U.S.-born players in NHL history, and trails only Joel Mullen, 60. Matt Furtado didn't have the benefit of reviewing Pulaski's expansive resume when he formed a first impression of his future teammate back in the summer of 2002. When I first saw Joe in a scrimmage game for training camp in Waterloo, I said to myself, "That's him," Furtado recently remembered. They spent 2 years together with the Blackhawks, winning a United States Hockey League division title that spring before going on to celebrate a Clark Cup championship in 2004. Furtado had discarded some initial assessment of Pulaski long before those achievements. In fact, he remembers already being impressed as their first season together was beginning. Being around him every day, you started to realize that he was a special player. The biggest things were his attention to detail and his hunger to grow and learn. He was always staying late and doing more than the rest of us, but it was never about him. Joe understood at a young age that if he made himself better, he could help the team more. Team. It was always important than individual, and Joe has always understood that. Defenseman Reed Cashman was on hand too, as the 2002-2003 Blackhawks were forming. The arc of Cashman's career, like Pulaski, was included rising to the NHL. The former assistant coach of the Washington Capitals is preparing for his first season as head coach of Dartmouth's men hockey program while making arrangements for the college championship. Cashman was also willing to reminisce. Our year together from Coach Handling's first meeting, Coach hammered home 2 points that were going to become part of the identity of the Waterloo Blackhawks organization. One, compete every day and compete in every aspect of your life, on the ice and off. Always strive to get better. Always strive to win. If the team has success, then individuals will have success. I think Joe has won as much as he has and has been as successful as he has, in large part due to him living those two ideas. Cashman and Pulaski were among the most successful Blackhawks at the 2002-2003 season ended. The defenseman from Red Wing, Minnesota, notched 47 points in 56 games and tied for the league scoring lead among players at his position. Cashman claimed a spot on the All-USHL second team before going on to All-American college career at Quinnipiac and time spent playing as a pro in North America and Europe. Pulaski was the 2003 USHL Rookie of the Year and took a step toward the NHL that summer when the San Jose Sharks drafted him 205th overall. After Pulaski had scored 36 goals and earned more than a point per game, 69 in 60 appearances, hindsight indicates that it was a remarkably value pick. Forward Garrett Regan played with the Hawks before and after the Minnesota high school hockey season in 2002 and 2003, came to Waterloo full-time in 2003 and 4, joining a club which had begun establishing a new culture of winning. Joe is just a winner, says Regan. He doesn't make a big deal about it. That's just all he knows and all he expects. It's fun to be around those type of players and people because there isn't any other option for him. Reagan says Pavelski's impact came with the way he played the game rather than what he said. Serving as Waterloo's captain in 2003 and 2004, Pavelski was the steadying influence as the Hawks struggled through the early months of the season. For a time, the talented team was at the bottom of the standings before rallying in the second half of the schedule to reach the playoffs, then defeating both division champions on the way to the Clark Cup. Regan's was the Hawks' third highest scoring during the playoff run with 11 points. He and Pavelski each earned scored six times. Zach Beerson was one of the youngest players on the 2003-2004 team. He would later become a Blackhawks captain, an NHL draft pick, and a Wisconsin Badger, following Pavelski's trail in each of those directions. While Pavelski's teammates consistently reinforced the idea that his leadership was primarily by example, some of Pavelski's words have also stuck with Beerson. He told me, sitting on his balcony in Madison, that he thought about hockey like he thought about golf, which is clearly awesome at its also. That it be truly great, you have to be well-rounded, capable of hitting all the shots, Beerson said. I think his career probably reflects that mature approach. I think about that metaphor all the time in that professional business world. Just improving in all facets, never being satisfied. Give credit to 21-year-old Joe with the sage wisdom and advice. Pete MacArthur tied Pavelski as the 2003-2004 Hawks playoff scoring leader with a dozen points. The forward, one of the limited number of Pavelski's Waterloo teammates who is still playing, offered his assessment of Pavelski's talents, which have improved with time. Truthfully, I think he was just fine-tuned his skills set over the years. He was never an unreal skater, blowing by people or dangling guys. His hockey IQ is off the charts, which allows him to be constantly being in the perfect or close to perfect position. Frattante says Pavelski's game has evolved, providing new opportunities to contribute, first as a veteran for the Sharks and his season with the Dallas Stars. If you look early in his career, his goals were a lot more off the rush or timers from the dot. He scored more goals with his shot. As the games has changed, he has found ways to continue to produce by finding new ways to score goals. This is where tipping pucks come from. He worked at it for years before he started to benefit his game. A key lesson for any young athlete is that these skills take time to cultivate, practice, and become perfect. I think Joe has touched so many people in so many ways throughout his career that the culmination of him winning the cup will mean so much to many of us. Notes for Fronte. He has a lot of people pulling for him. We'll get back to more news. Waverly chooses developer for Red Fox Inn by Jeff Renatz. Waverly. The Waverly City Council has backed a plan to renovate the former landmark Red Fox Inn into apartments, hotel rooms, and an event center. A 4-2 vote, the council chose to pursue a $3.5 million proposal by recently formed 1879 Ventures over a proposal by longtime community members Bartles Lutheran Retirement. Council member Brian Bergen, Rodney Drecko, Heather Burfield, and Tim Kangas voted in favor. Members Chris Glasser and Matthew Schneider voted against the proposal after favoring Bartles' competing proposal. Member Ann Rothy abstained because of her connections with Bartles. Council members said both proposals were promising and had risen to the top from a field of five outfits expressing an interest in taking on the Red Fox. The inn, located at 1900 Heritage Way on the city's western edge, has been derelict for years and was acquired by the city in the spring after property taxes went unpaid. Under the plan, the city would sell the property and negotiate a development agreement. 1859 Ventures is proposing turning the Red Fox East building into 34 market-rate apartments in the initial phase followed by the 48 hotel units, which could be turned into extended stay accommodations depending on demand, in a subsequent phase involving the West Building, according to an online outline of the project. Redeveloping the South Building for an event center and restaurant would follow. Our purpose is to take the existing Red Fox Inn and redevelop it and keep it something the City of Waverly can look at as kind of a cool place to be in town for the future development and also serve as a gateway into the community, said Brett Tiggs of 1859. The project would add 15 garage stalls for residents and other outdoor improvements like a dog park and resident gardens. New job creation would be around 100, according to organizers. Plans call for the first phase to start in 2021. The company has pre-approval of up to $1.3 million from a bank and $330,000 in owner's capital for the first phase, according to the outline. Proceeds from phase one would help fund the subsequent phases under the plan. The Bartles projection envisioned turning the East Building into a 30 independent living units for residents age 55 and over, with the front building holding offices, retail, a theater, childcare, and a salon. The West Building and pool area would be renovated next, followed by a restaurant and events center to the South Building. Bartles' plan was projected to cost more than $8 million. Grassley and Ernst ready for Supreme Court confirmation process. Des Moines. If U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell begins the confirmation of President Donald Trump's nominee to fill a Supreme Court vacancy before the November election, as he has said he will do, Senator Chuck Grassley, Iowa, said Monday, he will fulfill his responsibility to evaluate the nominee on the merits, just as I always have. Grassley, who as Judiciary Committee Chairman in 2016, incurred the wrath of Democrats when he refused to hold hearings on then-President Barack Obama's nomination for Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. He cited the so-called Biden rule that stemmed from a speech then-Senator Joe Biden made in 1992, saying that the Senate should not fill a high court vacancy until after the presidential election. Grassley said earlier this year that's still his position. If I were chairing the committee, based on what I told people in 2016, I could not process the nomination, Grassley said in July when there were concerns about the health of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died last week. However, in a statement Monday, Grassley said there are significant differences between the current situation and the 2016 vacancy. While there was ambiguity about the American people's will for the direction of the Supreme Court in 2016 under a divided government, there is no such ambiguity in 2020, Grassley said. The vacancy and interest in what type of justice would nominate were among the keys for voters' minds when they elected Trump 4 years ago, Grassley said. In 2018, having witnessed President Donald Trump appoint two justices to the court, voters reaffirmed their support for the president by expanding the GOP majority in the Senate, which has the responsibility of evaluating Supreme Court nominee, he said. And while his preference has been to not take a Supreme Court nomination in an election year, Grassley has no doubts Democrats would prefer if they held the majority. Make no mistake. If the shoe were on the other foot, Senate Democrats wouldn't hesitate to use their constitutional authority and anything else at their disposal to fill the seat, he said. Also Monday, Republican Senator Joni Ernst issued a statement to say that once Trump announces his nominee, I will carry out my duty as a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee to evaluate the nominee for our nation's highest court. Trump is expected to announce his nominee later this week. Okay. Woman arrested for hitting woman with her car in Waterloo by Jeff Renazzi. Waterloo. A Waterloo woman has been arrested for allegedly running over another woman following a dispute last weekend. Waterloo police arrested Marilyn Lynn Murren, 30, on Friday on charges of simple assault and serious injury by vehicle. Her bond was set at $35,000. Police were called to a dispute involving Murren and 28-year-old Caitlin Woods in the 1100 block of Logan Avenue around 2:50 p.m. September 5th. When officers arrived, they found Woods on the ground in the alley. She was flown to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. She suffered broken bones and internal injuries. Authorities allege Murren was driving in a reckless manner with disregard for the safety of others when she hit Woods. Court records allege Murren went to the address because of a dispute with Woods' boyfriend. At some point, Murren slapped Woods in the face. After the slap, Murren attempted to leave in her Chevrolet Impala, and Woods attempted to open the vehicle's door as Murren put the car in reverse, according to court records. Woods was pulled under the vehicle, and Murren then drove off and went home. Serious injury by vehicle is punishable up to 5 years in prison upon conviction. Okay, our next news. UNI Scholarship Benefit Concert goes virtual on September 25th. Cedar Falls, a special performance atop of the University of Northern Iowa's campanile by guest artist and Carol Lerner, Carol Kelderman, will highlight a platinum celebration, the 39th Annual Scholarship Benefit Concert. Hosted by the UNI School of Music, this is the first ever virtual concert for the concert series and will go live online at 7:30 p.m. Friday, September 25th at www.music.uni.edu/SBC. The concert also marks the anniversary of a 20-year-long collaboration with the Gallagher Blue Dorm Performing Arts Center. This year's event will be very different than what we were used to, but a truly exceptional and unique experience. The process has been really neat to be a part of, with faculty, students, and guests filming their performances ahead of time, and Sean Pollitt from the Gallagher Blue Dorm staff and Sean O'Neill from the university's relations working like crazy to film, edit, and pull it all together, said Carolyn Francis, School of Music Communication and Operations Coordinator. The online concert will be filled with performances by student and faculty, musicians including the UNI Faculty String Quartet, Danley Sewell with electronic music, pianist Vontag Kanvashali, flutist Hannah Porter Osenia, and UNI opera students with faculty pianist Corey Bardet, percussionist Kammer Milan, and UNI faculty jazz quintet. We're excited for the opportunity to showcase our programs and performers while utilizing the Gallagher Blue Dorm's fantastic four-camera technology and outstanding audio capabilities, said Jeffrey Vanderbark, School of Music Director. Kellerman's has been the visiting artist, Carolinier, on campus since longtime Carolinier and UNI Varsity Men's Glee Club Director Bob Burns died in 2004. He customarily visits the two performers in spring and two more performances in the fall. The piece he'll play is titled Ballet Mistral, and his own composition, dedicated to Bob and his Caroline legacy at UNI, said Francis, describing Kelderman's as an extremely talented. She said the film of Kelderman's performance is, from a brand new perspective, that most folks have never seen. Kelderman's performing at the top of the campanile with close-up images of the Caroline bells, aerial shots of the campus, and live audio captured as he played on the bench of the Caroline inside the campanile. The scholarship benefit concert has been raising scholarship funds for exceptionally talented music students and students in need since 1982. To become a special donor or to support scholarships for UNI music students, visit https://www.adv.uni.edu/foundation/SOMSBC.edu. ASPX. While we wish that we could share our usual concert hall experience with you, we hope that you'll join us online for this safe, socially distanced musical adventure, said Francis. Well, it won't be the same as sitting in the hall and being wowed by the enormity of our program. It's a more intimate, extremely engaging, and exciting. Hope Martin Park in Waterloo to receive new shelter and other improvements, by Sydney Sison. Waterloo. The city plans to replace the demolished shelter at Hope Martin Park and make other improvements, including spreading topsoil, mulching, and fertilizing the area. The park, located on Fletcher Avenue and Highway US 63, received three bidders for its project. Clarksville Company, Lodge Construction, provided the lowest bid at $131,000. Other bidders include Waterloo Company, Cardinal Construction, with a $139,000 proposal, and Woodruff Construction, with a $163,683 offer. The shelter construction alone will cost each company more than $100,000, according to bid documents. Waterloo City Council unanimously approved the project plans and submitted the bids for review at last Monday's meeting. The city did not yet announce which company it plans to choose for the project. Jamie Knutson, city engineer, said other work to the park includes new concrete, which will include a connection between the shelter and restrooms. Paul Hooten, leisure service director, said the shelter will be built high enough to avoid flooding issues from the nearby Cedar River. He added that the new shelter will be similar to the one at the Sherwood Park Recreation Area, located on Greenhill Road and Greenwood Avenue. We've been planning and replacing the shelter for about 6 years now, Hooten said at last Monday's meeting. Bullet hits door in Waterloo home in shooting, by Jeff Fernazzi. Waterloo. Police are investigating a weekend shooting in Waterloo. Neighbors reported hearing gunshot in the 500 block of Boston Avenue around 10:25 p.m. Sunday, and officers found a bullet had pierced a door at 530 Boston Avenue. People were inside the home, but no injuries were reported, according to police. Officers found spent shell casings in the area. No arrests have been made in the shooting. Our next article, Waterloo City Council extends mask update for another 6 weeks. Waterloo. The Waterloo City Council approved an extension of the citywide mask mandate on a 4-2 vote Monday evening. The mandate will be in place for another 6 weeks before being reconsidered, according to the resolution. It requires people to wear masks inside public buildings when within 6 feet of others, and when using transportation services. People with certain health conditions, children under 2, and public safety employees are exempt from the mandate. Council members passed the initial mask guidelines in late August, which were set to expire at the end of September. The first mandate was approved on a 6-1 vote. Council member Margaret Klein was the only vote against the original proposal in August. When the extension was brought before the council, member Dave Boyson joined Klein in voting against it Monday. Boyson repeated comments made in August about the mandate's lack of enforcement. He said businesses, which are advised not to serve customers without masks, are left to penalize people who don't obey the mandate, causing them to potentially lose out on sales. Klein said business owners are now policemen in their own businesses and are not trained to be in that role. We will have this issue pitting people against others until we have a federal or state mandate, Boyson said Monday. Klein said wearing masks should be an individual choice for people to determine their own futures. I think we are becoming too much of a nanny state, Klein said Monday. There are adults in this city who elected us, and the adults in this city know enough to wear masks. The guidelines state that enforcement of the mandate is up to Mayor Quinton Hart, and that the requirements are not meant to be stigmatizing or punitive. Jonathan Gritter, who introduced the mask mandate, said the guidelines continue to be important, especially given that 86 people in Blackhawk County died from COVID-19 as of Monday. He credited the mask mandate for slowing the spread of the virus in recent weeks. State data shows that the county's rolling total of positive cases has declined since September 5th. Hopefully, we can get within the CDC guidance of a lower positivity rate so that we don't have to re-up this again in 6 weeks, Greider said. But this is the smart, scientific, neighborly thing to do. Council member Sharon Wan led the meeting in Mayor Quentin Hart's absence. She said a mask mandate is needed if the community wants the virus to stop. People that are saying that they don't like to be told what to do, we tell them to wear seatbelts. We tell them to stop at stop signs. We tell them to obey speed limits, Wan said. With this mandate, we're helping our neighbors, helping our families. Councilmember Jerome Amos was absent for Monday's meeting. Cedar Falls passed its mask mandate in recent weeks. It differs from the Waterloo mandate by providing an exemption for children under age 5 rather than 2. The Blackhawk County Board of Supervisors will consider passing its own mask mandate Tuesday morning. The County Health Board approved the resolution September 2nd after a public hearing with community members. The proposed countywide mandate resembles Waterloo guidelines, but unlike Waterloo, the county resolution calls for the mandate to be enforceable with misdemeanor-level fines for violators. And that will be our next local news. Cedar Falls approves citywide mandate on a 4-3 vote. Cedar Falls. Nearly a month of discussion, the Cedar Falls City Council joined Waterloo in passing a citywide mask mandate on a split vote at Tuesday night's council meeting. Council members Frank Dara, Kelly Dunn, Simon Harding, and Mark Miller voted in favor of the resolution, which goes into effect immediately and will be in effect for 6 weeks. To me, this is a health care crisis, and we are addressing a health care crisis, Dunn said, of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. I still believe the goal of this is to educate. Susan DeBoer, Daryl Cruz, and Dave Sires voted against it, saying they preferred a strong recommendation to a mandate. I feel that the mandate divides the community rather than unites us, DeBoer said. Who's going to be enforcing it? Who do people call? The mandate, which carries no penalty for noncompliance, requires those within city limits to wear a face covering when in public places, where they can't social distance inside all indoor public settings, including businesses, but not including one's own home, and while using public transportation. People do not have to wear a mask inside their own vehicles when exercising, when seated at a restaurant, or when obtaining a service requiring the removal of a face covering. Law enforcement, firefighters, and emergency medical personnel are exempt, as well as those breathing difficulties or other medical or behavioral conditions. The resolution was modeled after Waterloo's, but council members, on a 4-3 vote, amended the wording to only require masks among those older than 5, rather than 2 years of age. Harding swung his vote for the amendment. There's been some research on what's coming out of the World Health Organization, and talks are starting about limiting kids under 5 from wearing the mask, Harding said. The World Health Organization did note in an August 21 section of its website that children age 5 and under should not be required to wear a mask, but County Health Director Nafasa Sis-Ibana said her department doesn't get its guidance from the World Health Organization, and the Center for Disease Control still recommends masks for ages 2 and up. Unless the CDC changes those guidelines, the Blackhawk County Health Department will not, she said. Public comment varied widely on the subject. University of Northern Iowa President Mark Nook and College Hill Partnership Director Catherine Sogard were among those in favor of the mandate. For our students and employees to stay safe, we need citizens in the community to take the same precautions we are taking on campus, Nook said, warning no action might force a return to online-only education. Others, like T.J. Furin, said having a mandate with no enforcement was a giant waste of time and forces businesses owners into unnecessary confrontation. We shouldn't be forcing businesses to turn customers away simply for not wearing a mask, he said. The council was as divided as the public. A mandate has to be enforceable, Ward 3 member Cruz said, motioning for a strong recommendation instead. What's the point? For lack of a better word, it's nonsense to do it that way. Ward 1 member Miller compared it to the city's law on fireworks. Hard to enforce, but better to have it in the books anyway. We're looking at an unprecedented situation here, and we're trying to find a compromise, Miller said. You're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, September 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. All right, James A. Abels, 1946 to 2020. James A. Abels, 74, of Oak Harbor, Washington and Grundy Center, passed away on September 16, 2020. James was born on August 25, 1946 in Waterloo, Iowa, to Jacob and Leora Miller Abels. Following the graduation from Grundy Center High School, Jim continued his education at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. After receiving a bachelor's degree in mathematics, he was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force. Jim spent 20 years in the Air Force, retiring as a major. After having been stationed in Texas, Colorado, Germany, Hawaii, and Vietnam. In the Vietnam War, he flew the O-2 as a forward air controller. He was also an F-4 pilot and flight instructor at the United States Air Force Academy. In retirement, Jim spent his time writing and publishing unique political satire and doing deep research for current world events. Left to cherish Jim's memory are his brother and wife, Diane Abels, nephew Stephen Joy Abels, Douglas and Karen Abels, Jonathan and Lisa Abels, his niece, Elizabeth, and James Williams, 12 great-nephews and nieces, and many friends, including Nick and Marilyn Haran and daughters. Jim was preceded in death by his parents, Jacob and Leoa Abels. A memorial service will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the charity of the sender's choice. God bless the family and all those who mourn. Ingalls Funeral Home of Grundy Center is in charge of the arrangements. Lynn Arnholtz. Lynn Dunkerton Arnholtz, a resident of Wheaton, Illinois, formerly of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, Iowa area, died July 11, 2020. She was preceded in death by her husband of 59 years, Dr. Don Arnholtz, who died September 17, 2019. A memorial visitation in remembrance of Don and Lynn will be held on Saturday, September 26th, from 2 to 3 p.m. in the Fellowship Hall at the Bible Conference Grounds, 439 North Division in Cedar Falls. Carol Anderson, 1944 to 2020. Carol Ann Anderson, 75, of Cedar Falls, died Wednesday, September 16, 2020, at the Cedar Valley Hospice Home in Waterloo. She was born December 2, 1944, in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, the daughter of Nicholas and Antonio Kusher Pavich. Carol married Norman E. Anderson on April 24, 1978, at the Little Brown Church near Nashua, Iowa. He preceded her in death on November 20, 2015. Carol was a teacher at several schools, including NU High and UNI, both in Cedar Falls. Carol is survived by her son, Norman E. Bree Anderson, Jr., of Maitland, Florida, and two stepchildren, George W. Anderson and Charlene C. Fitzgerald. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband, and a stepdaughter, Nancy J. Perroth. Services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, September 26th, 2020 at St. John Lutheran Church with burial at Fairview Cemetery, both in Cedar Falls. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday at Dahl Van Hoof Shoe Funeral Home. City and state mandates require visitors to wear masks and social distance. Memorials may be directed to the church or to the National Education Association. More information at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Gladys Batchelor, 1932 to 2020. On August 23, 2020, Gladys Ald Batchelder passed away unexpectedly at the age of 87. She is preceded in death by her husband, Wayne, son Steve, and grandchildren, Christopher Lorg, and Melissa, Rebecca, and Laura Eastburn. She is survived by two daughters, Kathy and Ed Eastburn, and Connie and Michael Lorg, daughter-in-law, Margaret Batchelor, sister, Margaret Melanie, and seven grandchildren, Christina and Brian Ward, Sarah Lorge, Kyle and Molly Lorg, Brittany and Ben Pooland, Stephanie Eastburn, Aaron and Phil Dietrich, Thomas and Hannah Batchelder, great-grandson Stephen Batchelder, and beloved dog Boston that loved and admired her deeply. Gladys was born on October 22, 1932 in Plainfield, Iowa. She moved to Minnesota for college and met the love of her life, Wayne, and created a life for her family in Minnesota. Gladys loved traveling and was able to go on her lifelong dream trip to Hawaii in February of 2020. She enjoyed weekly family dinners, making her famous peanut butter cookies. She also enjoyed flowers and time on the deck. Gladys was loving, kind, compassionate, and always finding thoughtful ways to make others feel good. She was truly one of a kind and has impacted countless people with whom she came in contact with. In light of current events, a flamingo celebration of life will be held at a later date in the spring of 2021. A private immediate family service was held on Monday, August 31st, 2020. Contact her daughter, Connie, at 763-370-7278 for more information. Paula Choplin, 1945 to 2020. Paula Choplin was born October 26, 1945. She passed away peacefully on March 17, 2020 from complications of dementia. Paula was the daughter of Winfred and Pauline Poppy Howard Gillette. She married the love of her life, Tom Choplin, on May 20, 1967. Her family will honor her with the celebration of life on Friday, September 25th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at 5507 Young Road, Waterloo, Iowa. There will be a brief service at 4 p.m. The family requests no flowers, please. Memorial may be directed to the Brain Injury Alliance of Iowa online at https://biaia.org or by mail to 7025 Hickman Road, Suite 7, Urbandale, Iowa, 50322. Okay, we'll turn our attention to some sports today. Prep girls swimming Cedar Falls places second at Gary Winkler invite. Fort Dodge. Cedar Falls placed second out of five teams during a tough test Saturday at Fort Dodge Gary Winkler invite. West Des Moines Dowling won 8 of the 11 events to capture the team championship with 590 points. Cedar Falls finished with 486 total points, ahead of Sioux City, who had 341, Fort Dodge, 321, and Spencer, 284. Kendall Marlarlo led the Tigers when she outtouched Dowling's Mary Sweetman for second place in the 200 individual medley with a time of 2 minutes 16 seconds to the competitors 2 minutes and 31 hundredths to the competitors 2 minutes 16 seconds and 53 hundredths. Marlalo later edged Mary Martin of Dowling by 9 hundredths of a second for second place in the 100 butterfly with a time of 1 minute and 6 hundredths to her competitor with 1 minute and 69 hundredths. Other sports news. Updated football roundup. Coleman rushes for 192 in Hudson victory. Hudson improved to 2-2 overall after Joel Coleman rushed for 192 yards during its 20-0 win over East Marshall of LeGrand. Bryce Griffin had a pair of touchdown runs in the first half, and the Pirates built a 14-0 halftime lead. Coleman capped off the scoring with a 7-yard touchdown run in the fourth quarter. Isaac Messmore and Lyle Olson each recorded first-half interceptions for Hudson. St. Ansgar won 54 over West Fork 21 in football. Carter Saul carried the ball 37 times for 170 yards and 6 scores as the second-ranked Saints pulled away from the Wahawks. The team traded first-half touchdowns. The score stood at 21-21 before St. Ansgar scored the final 33 points. The Saints rushed for 437 yards and 65 carries. Denver beat Jessup 21-6 last Friday night. Isaac Besh rushed for 139 yards and also passed for a touchdown in the Cyclone win. Caden Baumgartner had 36-yard touchdown catch for Denver. All right, let's see what other sports news we have for the Cedar Valley. Iowa and Iowa State expect hefty budget shortfalls. Steve Batterson. A fall without football as usual on the campuses of Iowa's three state universities is reflected in athletic budgets on the Iowa Board of Regents will receive next Wednesday. In documents released this week before the Big Ten announced plans for a shortened football season, Iowa projected a loss of nearly $96.9 million in income compared to a year ago. Iowa State, which began a 10-game football season with no fans in the stands last weekend, participated in a revenue decline of $41.6 million. And Northern Iowa, expecting to play 4 home football games next spring, is budgeting for a revenue decrease of just over $625,000. Both Iowa and Iowa State expect hefty budget shortfalls during the ongoing fiscal year, which began July 1st. Iowa Director of Athletics Gary Barta said on August 24th that the program he oversees anticipates seeking a loan of about $75 million to counter what he has budgeted to a shortfall of $74,751,566 in its athletic budget for the current fiscal year. Barta said Thursday, television and radio broadcast income from the 9-game schedule the Big Ten announced a day earlier will provide Iowa with additional revenue. At the end of the day, the net will be better, but it will be a much reduced amount because we're not going to play a full schedule, Barta said. With no fans, we don't have ticket revenue, we don't have the donations that go with the seats, and we're going to have much reduced revenue in all other categories. Numbers remain soft at this point, but Barta said the Iowa budget shortfall may go this fiscal year from the initial projected $75 million to around $55 million. It will be better, but far from relief, Barta said. There will be additional expense in the daily rapid antigen testing that will be part of the routine for Iowa football players by the next week and for every Hawkeye in every program as they return to action. The Big Ten is currently negotiating with companies to find the best price, but Barta indicated it will come with a significant cost that will be shared by all 14 Big Ten institutions. Iowa is reducing expected expenses in this year's budget by just over $22 million, and Barta said all cuts, including the elimination of 4 sports programs and the cuts in salaries and furloughs of staff members will remain in place despite the return of football. The budget Iowa laid out for approval by the Regents projected a loss of $97.9 million in operating expenses for the fiscal year of 2021, a number that will be reduced with the return of potential revenue from television and radio broadcasts and bowl participation for the Big Ten teams. The current Iowa budget includes major declines in revenue from the Big Ten, including income from the Big Ten Network, and in its Learfield multimedia contract, which includes the Hawkeye Radio Network, as well as marketing opportunities at Kinnick Stadium and Carver Hawkeye Arena. Iowa received $52,356,187 from the conference and $7,556,285 from its Learfield contract during the 2020 fiscal year. In the budget presented to Regents, Iowa projects $10 million in the Big Ten revenue and $1.5 million from its Learfield deal, numbers that will grow with the return of football. BARDA is also presenting a budget which includes no anticipated income from football during the current fiscal year compared to the $21,599,677 generated by the Hawkeye program during the 2020 fiscal year. Football expenses at Iowa are being trimmed from $30.4 million to $23.9 million in the proposed budget. The Iowa budget also assumes having normal winter and spring competition with reduced attendance capacity. The budget Iowa State Director of Athletics Jamie Pollard will present to the region includes no income from ticket sales in any sport the Cyclones compete in during the current fiscal year. Ticket sales accounted for just under $18.6 million for the Iowa State University budget in the 2020 fiscal year. Football generated $13,335,112 in ticket sales for Iowa State a year ago, dollars that are non-existent in this year's budget. Iowa State University, which breaks salary and additional football support areas into other budget categories, spent $6.8 million on football operations a year ago. It has $4.8 million budgeted for operational expenses in the sport in 2021. Iowa State anticipates a budget shortfall of approximately $35 million during the current fiscal year. Northern Iowa is the only one of the three institutes to present a balanced proposed budget. UNI lists projected income and expenses of $12,767,563 for the 2021 fiscal year. The Director of Athletics, David Harris, also presented a budget which includes reduced across-the-board salary and operating expenses. The UNI budget assumes the Panthers will play four home football games with limited capacity next spring, anticipating revenue of $317,725 compared to the $1,202,759 the program generated last season. Football expenses at Northern Iowa will be a slight reduction, dropping from $3.6 million in 2020 to $3.3 million in the proposed budget. UNI also assumes a conference-only men's basketball schedule with limited capacity at nine home games. Like Iowa, Iowa State University is looking for creative ways to bridge this year's budget gap. While Iowa plans to seek a loan, Iowa State may fund its shortfall in part by accessing unrestricted resources held by the athletic department and university. The use of those dollars would be temporary and repaid by the Iowa State University Department of Athletics over time. Under previous directives from the regents, athletic departments at both Iowa and Iowa State are self-supporting and receive no tax dollars or monies from the university's general funds. Iowa met that goal in 2007, while Iowa State achieved that in 2012. Northern Iowa, which receives no substantial revenue from conference distributions expects to receive $3.2 million in university support for athletics operations, down from the $3.4 million in the 2020 fiscal year. Athletic departments at all three Regent institutions continue to pay their institutions the cost of the scholarships it awards to student athletes. All right, and that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, September 22nd. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once-weekly or twice-monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.